I am one of the founders of Pinge, and I'm really happy to be here tonight because it means I don't have to be at the Golden Quills Journalism and Media Award. So, yeah, Brittany Hiller is there for me instead. We formed Pinge about 2 years ago, and we're really excited to have survived this long. I've been covering books and literature here in Pittsburgh for a long time, and really try to focus on local writers, but expand that understanding to include Northern Appalachia and parts of the West Coast. I am currently at work on a book about literature in Appalachia for West Virginia University Press. That's what I'm going to read to you from tonight. I've become curious about how writers in the region, you know, craft and reflect and interpret the region for readers here. And the book is also part memoir. All right. All right. So the book is also part memoir, which is to say, I put myself in the story in a way that I don't when I'm doing the journalism. So it is partly about growing up in a small mill town in Western Pennsylvania and my evolving understanding of this place, of Pittsburgh as part of Appalachia and how I fit in it. I've been on the road a lot, traveling the region. So I'm going to read from a chapter that is about the pressure to leave Appalachia, the pressure to leave hard places. It's about my own experience with that, but it's also about how artists are interpreting that for us. Quote, "The beauty forcing us as much as harshness." Jack Gilbert, Searching for Pittsburgh. There was a time in my young adult life when it felt like I lost a friend every week. Not that they died necessarily, although some did. I moved into the city at the end of the 1980s and began the process of coming out. It was the height of the AIDS crisis, and for a gay person in Pittsburgh or anywhere, death was never far. Keith Haring died, then Freddie Mercury, and lots of people you never heard of died too. Just as much, there was a steady decline as people simply moved away. The exodus wasn't biblical and the constant drip of leaving wasn't a daily or even weekly occurrence. But a diaspora did happen. The steel industry doomed. Everything just folded in on itself. Although the flight has now taken on mythic proportions in its retelling, and lots of us did stay, I do recall with sharp clarity times when I hesitated to cultivate new friendships. Such was the relentlessness to the drain. You should move to Charlotte, to Phoenix, to Houston, to DC, to Seattle. That's what people said. Move someplace without rotting steel mills and abandoned train yards and old slag heaps. Move someplace that wasn't a union town struggling to hang on in Reagan's America. Move someplace without the long gray Pittsburgh winters pressing down. Move somewhere where the old man bars and the union halls were raised or never were to begin with. Move to where things weren't painted with the residue and dregs of hard, dirty industry such that we could never get clean. Fill in the blank with that flavor of the month boomtown, that's where you should be. A place with shiny new developments and shopping areas and ever available office cubicle jobs. Those places made me feel shabby. Like I should watch the NASDAQ index breathlessly, or be trendier, or at the very least, want to shop more. In the mid-1990s, I'd lay in bed in my apartment in one of the city's more than 90 distinct neighborhoods and wonder if a place this big could disappear. I thought of abandoned skyscrapers and Three River Stadium crumbling and full of cobwebs. I pictured shuttered up homes along the rivers and creeks and through all the hollows of the city. I thought of kudzu covering the WPXI television tower. Maybe a Carnegie Library would remain standing, an oddity for tourists in a city of scant humans. I imagined Pittsburgh as the old gold rush place the family visited in a favorite episode of the Brady Bunch. In They Will Put My Body Into the Ground, poet Jack Gilbert wrote, "Even Pittsburgh will vanish, leaving a greed as tough as winter." I didn't know Gilbert's work back then, though he was a Pittsburgh guy, specifically an East Liberty Peabody High School guy. To be fair, I didn't know many poets then, but as a former literature major, I knew the Mobile canon. I had studied Wordsworth and Coleridge, Shelley, Byron, and Keats. I read Milton's Paradise Lost and Shakespeare's sonnets. I learned how to parse poetry, how to read Old English, and I think I even understood iambic pentameter, although it always seemed fake to me. These poems were intellectual puzzles to master, an academic's Rubik's Cube, or a math question in verbal form. None of them landed lower in my body than my forehead. Later in life, on my own, I found Lucille Clifton, and poetry opened up in a new way, warming my body from my lower abdomen to my chest. While researching this book, I attended several readings by the great Kentucky writer, Crystal Wilkinson. She said once that poetry lived in her gut, and I felt that too. Of course, she's creating poetry and I'm just taking it in, but it does seem to live in that place, inside your core. And I feel like if poetry lives where Crystal Wilkinson says it does, then I'm doing something right. I wonder now what it might have meant to have read James Baldwin's poetry when we were all living in the eye of the HIV storm, or to know poetry that spoke to workers. How might I have understood myself, my town, my place, had somebody pointed me to poets who wrote in the modern vernacular of industry and cities and labor and capitalism? It was many more years before I discovered the verse of Jack Gilbert, who worked briefly as a steelworker. And though most of his career was spent in Europe and then San Francisco, Pittsburgh's DNA is all over his work, like a messy crime scene. For me, Gilbert lights up the castaway forgotten places and people. He might have helped me understand why I stayed and saw beauty in such harsh, unappreciated places. Ashley Blooms grew up in an unappreciated place too. She grew up coal poor in a small place in Kentucky. In her brilliant 2022 novel, Where I Can't Follow, she combines a deep sense of home with a touch of magic to explore complicated feelings around loving a hard place and choosing to stay. Her protagonist, Maren Walker, lives with her grandmother in the fictional town of Black Dam, Kentucky, named such for the deadly asphyxiant mine gas. Blooms told me about the first time she heard of Black Dam from her miner father. They were going to be mining close to a much older mine that had been long since abandoned, and that was one of their concerns. They were not wanting to cut into an old shaft because it could contain black damp, she said. But she also remembered just loving the sound of it, black damp. It sounded like being inside a coal cocoon. Blooms' town of Black Damp is not a real place, though it is wholly real life Eastern Kentucky, a place ravaged by extractive industry and the opioid epidemic. It is also a place of extraordinary beauty, so ruthless and dramatic, it's hard to take in all at once. Blooms' writing, born from and of her home place, rings true in all its contradictions. When we meet Maren, she's trying to care for her granny as the elder woman slides slowly toward dementia. She works at a convenience store, skips lunch almost daily to try to save even a tiny bit of money, and struggles to pay off a small, but for her, insurmountable debt. She has lived with her indomitable and sometimes difficult granny since she was little, since her mom left. Now, as a young adult, Maren feels she owes it to her granny to take care of her so the woman can breathe her last in her very own home. It's also hard, and living on the knife's edge of poverty, Maren feels it all slipping away. And here, Blooms pulls a rabbit out of a hat. Not everyone, but many people in Black Damp get a little door, an interdimensional portal, not wholly understood, but accepted by the population of the novel. It's an escape hatch or a paranormal exit. It's not clear where one goes after going through the door. Do they vanish into the ether? Does it lead to death? An alternate reality, a different dimension? Do they go to the upside down? Nobody knows. But the mystery of the gateway is accepted. Maren's door appears in a field behind the modest house she shares with Granny. It's not really a door. It doesn't look like the door to your house or your bedroom closet or a Walmart. It's earthier and more organic, like a ball of dirt and moss and sticks and clay. But Maren knows it's her door. She could just leave. She could leave behind feeling overwhelmed and intense economic pressure. She could just walk through the door and let go of that rope she's clinging to with everything she has. There is a point at which Maren, beyond desperate, pulls up in her bedroom reading her mother's old journals. I didn't want to make choices. I didn't want to explain myself. I just wanted to read, Blooms writes. And every one of us, every kid who found joy in words on a page, who wanted or needed to escape through books, can relate to Marin in that moment, even if we've never set foot in Eastern Kentucky. But Marin stays, and not just out of obligation. She stays because she loves the place. She loves her friends. She stays because the mountains feel right and it feels like home. And when she thinks of leaving, she thinks of going only as far as Lexington, only a couple hours away. Blooms told me that sometimes she writes out of spite more than anything else, which seems as good a reason to me as any. Telling stories that feel more authentic to my experience and adding them to that conversation so that it doesn't feel so much like there are important things that are getting left out or overlooked, Bloom said, that means a lot to me. Writing about that struggle of trying to stay in a place that doesn't feel like it's always made for you, but it is also made for you, and you feel like you were made for it. That struggle of trying to make a home in a place that isn't really hospitable all the time. My wife is a therapist. She thinks about things differently than I do. She tells me this thing about how our brains contain a map of our lives, a map of the people we're close to in the center, and it works its way out. I think of it like a heat map, showing the inner circle of one's own life and lightening in color or intensity as it works its way away. She tells me about research on how grief disorders our brain map. When someone dies, the map remains and our brain has to hold conflicting information. That person's location in the brain map, and that person is dead and gone. When that person is an anchor in your heat map, when they're at or near the center, it can throw everything off keel. Years after my mother's death, my brain is still holding conflicting information. I wonder if that's just true with moms. I wonder too, if this applies to physical space and topography. Separate from the trauma and loss of 9/11, I think how disoriented New Yorkers must have felt for the longest time, seeing a skyline without the Twin Towers. At home, when I drive across the Homestead Grays Bridge connecting Squirrel Hill to Homestead, I think of Carnegie's Colossus steel operation that is now an ill-conceived sprawling shopping area. The smokestacks remain to remind us of what used to be there and how you can't replace that with a chain brewery and movie theater. I also wonder this when I drive through Western Pennsylvania and Eastern Kentucky and West Virginia, when I pass deserted coal tipples and abandoned beehive ovens. I spent some time in Hazard, Kentucky and talked to a couple of fierce women there who fight for clean water and fight against mountaintop removal. I wonder how long it will take for their brains to adjust to the missing mountaintops.